Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
5 a.m., I'm up with a crisp Celsius energy drink. Running 12 miles today. Grab a green juice, quick change, and head to work. Meetings, workshops, one more Celsius, no slowing down. Working late, but obviously still meeting the girls for a little dancing. Celsius, live, fit, go. Grab a cold, refreshing Celsius at your local retailer or locate now at Celsius.com.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic? With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway, wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's the trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence, helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
Hey guys, before we start, a quick shout out to Alpha Dog Nutrition for sponsoring this podcast. Alpha Dog products are now available at dusupply.com, and you can use code ALPHADOG15 at checkout for 15% off and a credit for free shipping to try it yourself. Now let's get you to your podcast.
Where's Fielder?
He's gone to the dogs.
Welcome to the Gone to the Dogs podcast. How privileged I am today. I have a guest that I am just chomping at the bit. That's your hint right there. To bring to the microphone in just a few minutes. But before I do, I just wanted to mention the people that make this podcast possible, and that's, of course, my good friend Buddy Woodbury and Jason Doobie out in Oregon and Washington State, respectively, I guess the word is, that make this possible every week. We really do appreciate them, and there's a new sponsor with the W Supply Group, the Alpha Dog Nutrition. Glad to have them aboard us as well. So anyway, we get the bills paid there before we get started. But today we're going to have an interesting podcast, I am sure, because we've got a very interesting guy that's going to share his time with us. As this podcast is airing, it is the 1st of July. If you can imagine that, that we've progressed already halfway through the calendar year. It just seems like to me the years just go by like a picket fence, you know, on a highway. But I believe on Thursday of this week will be the 4th of July, the birthday that we celebrate of our country. I'm a very patriotic guy. I know our guest is as well. And, you know, it's just such a privilege to be born in the USA and to have been raised here. And as I think of my guest from the great state of Texas, I remember back in my UKC days when we started the hunt there in College Station, Texas, and we had rodeo parades, and we had all the things. We had a soldier back from Desert Storm, and I realized that just this week, as I'm podcasting here, we celebrate it. I don't know that it, of course, we want to celebrate the lives of all those brave men and women that fought for our country in that sandbox over there, Desert Storm. But that event was the American Heritage Hunt, and it was one of the highlights of my, if you want to call it, career, to see that display of patriotism in a rodeo arena there. Probably had about 3,000 people all together there from our best estimate. But anyway, before I bring our guest to the microphone, last week we had just a very, very sharp young man named Caden Riley on the program. And Caden, of course, is spearheading this Peach State Shootout Georgia Youth Series. And if you listen to that podcast, you were probably as amazed as I was at this 19-year-old coon hunter to see the, well, number one, he's very articulate, extremely bright, and very focused. And it was just such a joy. And if you haven't heard that episode, you need to go back and listen to that one for sure. Okay, well, I've talked a lot here without saying much, but I'm very proud to bring to the microphone a guy from the great state of Texas. Now, I traveled to Texas many, many times over my years with the Coonhound Registries, and especially when I was with UKC, because every year in September we had the Texas State Championship. And in my day, it was held at the fairgrounds in Fairfield, Texas. And we're going to reminisce a little bit about that and all. I saw just this week, and I posted it to my Facebook page, where probably one of the most famous Texans at all, probably of all since Sam Houston, was my favorite country singer, George Strait, held a concert in the stadium at Texas A&M University there in College Station, 110,000 people. I can't wait to bring you on, man. My guest this week is Dexter Whatley from Bivens, Texas. Is that right, Dex?
That's it. Suburban Bivens.
Suburban Bivens.
Yeah. We're about 10 miles from downtown of Bivens, where the railroad track goes under the highway.
Ah, gotcha. Is Bivens one of those southern towns where the railroad track goes right down through the middle of town?
It actually splits it, right? I mean, it's got an overpass over it. And until the timber companies come through here and logged out so much, you never heard the train go through Bivens.
They didn't have to blow the whistle. at the crossing then, did they?
No, they had the right of way.
I got you. I know over in the southeast and just north of me and up through Georgia, probably South Carolina and up that way, it seems like the railroad track goes right down through the middle of town, parallels the highway. And if you want to make a left or right turn, you got to go. There'll be a gate there, you know, that you have to wait. You better wait. Let's put it that way. Well, I've still got my virus residue, I guess you'd call it. I've still got a tickle in my throat, hoarseness and all that. I don't know what those Chinese put in that bug. But it's been a bad one for me. So I'm hopefully I'll get through this. But I've got a guy here that probably likes to talk as much as I do. And I don't know that I need to lay that on your decks. That's a heavy cross to bear. But Dexter Whatley, you are a dyed-in-the-wool blue tick man. Are you not?
Pretty much so. I've owned a couple of Walker dogs way back when, and this was before the Lipper era, and they come from George Hicks, who actually sold Merchant Hustling Billy to John Wick, and one of them was a little male dog. That come along at the same time that I had the Domino dog when he was a puppy. And I had to make a choice between the two. And the little Domino dog seemed to be the tougher of the two, with me being young enough and tough enough to follow him.
Mm-hmm.
And I sold the dog to a gentleman out of Marshall, Texas, down in the blue tick stronghold down there, and he kept the dog for quite some time and made a whale of a squirrel dog and a pretty good coon dog out of him. But Domino cemented me in the blue tick world, and I ended up with his cousin Diesel just not long after a friend of mine passed away from a car wreck.
I see. Well, you know, when I went to Texas, my first trip out there was in courtesy of Uncle Sam in 1969. He invited me to come to Lackland for about 6 weeks of at a spa there they call Lackland.
Yes.
And so I spent that, what they called the basic training. They didn't probably know what they were in for trying to train me to do anything, West Virginia redneck. But no, and then I went up to San Angelo to what they called a tech school at Goodfellow Air Force Base there. And right away I met some coon hunters, and I learned real quick that the blue tick dog was very popular in Texas, especially out there in West Texas. There was one name that came to the front quite a bit out there, was a guy named Tom Broom. Did you ever meet Tom or hear of him or know anything
about
him?
Yes, I knew about him. I never met him.
Uh-huh.
I was friends with a gentleman named Mike Adams that had some of his stuff, and Mike also had running dogs. They would cross their blue ticks in on some running walkers for bobcat dogs.
I got you. That's what I've found, that those Western cat hunters like to put some of that running dog in there. Well, you're talking with crossed up blue ticks and things like that, right down Jason Doobie with W. I'm pretty sure that's what he's hunting. He's probably got some purple ribbon dogs, but the blue tick seemed really well suited. There was a fella named Boots Atwood out there around San Angelo, and he hunted blue dogs, I believe, and a boy named Smitty, I can't remember his first name from Louisiana that was in the Air Force. So anyway, I hunted with some good little blue tick female in some hunts out there. Her name was Okie, and she was a solid blue. She didn't have any red or tan trim on her at all. Well, listen, somewhere before you got Domino and got this merchant's hustling Billy Bread Walker and all that, you had a beginning in coon hunting. Where did that start for you, Dex?
Well, it was my grandpa. My first coon hunt was the Christmas after my daddy died when I was 9 years old. My daddy died on Thanksgiving Day.
Oh, my.
Mm. And anyway, Papa was going to go out, and he owned a 100-acre peach orchard. And that doesn't sound like a whole lot now, but that was a monstrous orchard.
I imagine.
And it was part of the starting point. It was kind of the apprenticeship of where a kid learned to coon hunt, rabbit hunt, deer hunt. And there wasn't very many deer in that country then. Mm-hmm. But my grandpa, I was told by some of the men that hunted with him in his younger days, that they said Raymond Maxey had coon dogs when everybody else owned a possum dog, and they're referring to right after the Depression.
I see. Yeah.
And he was a generic coon hunter. He would hunt anything, but his benchmark was a gray, black, and tan that he got from a Church of Christ preacher named C.F. Shirey. And Mr. Shirey is who brought my grandpa to the Lord. And it was basically in the woods, coon hunting was where they conversed and studied.
Well, that's great. That's great. Great story.
And
that was your grandfather?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Uh-huh.
Okay, I'm getting a noise there, Dex. Do you know what that is?
That's something in the kitchen, I think.
Oh, okay. Well, we got to have a kitchen.
That was Patsy.
If Patsy's in the kitchen, let's don't disturb her at all, because I think I'm pretty sure something good's going to come out of there.
Hey, she can do that now.
Okay, well, all right. So you started then hunting in that peach orchard with your grandpa?
Yeah, about 10, I was 9 and a half years old. I was 9 and a half years old. It was about less than a month after my daddy had passed away.
I see. Now, you have a brother or two, don't you?
I had a brother that passed away in 68, and he took more after, I mean, not 68, in 08, 2008.
Uh-huh. That's the year my father passed. Yeah.
And he was a roper. He was a cowboy, but he also had beagles. He ran beagles, and he would go on his annual coon hunt, but it had to be when frost was on the ground.
I got you. He didn't want to mess with them till it got. He was probably thinking. I'm just thinking ahead here. Did that involve taking the fur? Did he save the fur off those coon or sell hides or anything?
Oh, my grandpa. Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's absolutely probably why he's waiting for that. Well, that was your brother. You said that waited to the fall. Frost.
Yeah. Uh-huh. He was ducking snakes.
Oh, I got you.
He wasn't scared of them, but he didn't go looking for them.
Well, I live in Florida, as you know, and we've got all kinds of snakes here. You rarely ever see a rattlesnake, but you do see them occasionally. But they're on the high ground, up in the dry ridges and palmetto thickets and things like that. And of course, cottonmouths are what we find, you know, mostly when we're out. But I saw more snakes and rattlesnakes too when I was in Texas than I've ever seen anywhere. And it was, of course, we were in West Texas, Tom Green County out there around San Angelo. and those reservoirs and so forth they have out there. But we would walk around those cow paths and all, and it was nothing to see a big old rattler all doubled up or you know, stacked up in the cow path up there ahead of us. I've seen dogs come in toward us, our lights, and just jump right over them and come right on, you know. But, man, I saw a lot of rattlesnakes in Texas.
I quit counting rattlesnakes 4 foot and under, between 4 and 5 foot. When I got to 50, and I've killed, I don't know how many since, but I've killed two over 6 foot, and one was on September the 19th, 1992, when Bo Parker and I were judging the quarterfinals at Queen City, and that snake was 6 foot one, and had 19 rattlers and two little buttons.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, yeah, they were great. They were grown men running like and crying like little girls around him.
I bet I
killed him with a dog leash.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And
well,
for our young people, as a matter of safety, that is the best snake killer you've got. Don't look for a stick. Use that leash.
Yeah, I know. I was on a hunt down here about a year and a half ago, I guess, and. I walked along. I was hunting, or I had a walker dog at that time. My buddy Mac Britt was handling him, and we pulled up, and it was on one of Ike Rainey's properties down here. Some beautiful places to hunt, but Oliver Wynn, he's a fellow that handled the Z dog here recently in one of the world hunts. He got out of the truck, and all of a sudden I saw him. He had his leash, like you said, and he was beating the ground. I mean, he was tearing that ground up with that chain lead, you know. And I said, "What's going on, Oliver?" And he said, he just stepped right out of the truck right there in the two-track, and there was a moccasin right there. So, yeah, I don't like snakes. You know, I have them around the domicile here, and I don't bother them. I leave them alone because they're black snakes, and they're good, what I consider good snakes, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But anyway, they still startle me every time. I was on the patio, as I'm prone to do when the weather's cool enough. I was kicked back in one of those zero-gravity chairs. My brother says, "I hate them things. I can't get out of them once I get it." But anyway, I had dozed off, you know, and had a nice little nap, and opened up right there around my feet was a black snake. I said, "You better get out of here." And it took off around the side of the house. Anyway, well, we got off. Instead of chasing rabbits, we're chasing snakes here. But anyway, there in the state of Texas, you're in the northeast corner. And I think that's what we discussed maybe when we're at the Winter Classic. We talked a little bit. That's kind of called the Arklatex up there, isn't it?
The Arklatex is what it's known as. And one of my notorieties, I had, there's a little old place called Three States where Arkansas, Texas, and Oklahoma come together. And where I live, I'm at 8 miles from Louisiana, 15 miles from Arkansas, and I'm about 70 miles from Oklahoma. But I had a dog run a deer in Three States one night.
Well, you beat old Fred Moran. I had him on here the podcast is airing as we're recording this, and he talked about running a deer, I think, from Michigan to in Wisconsin, but you've got him beat. You got three states. Well, now that couldn't have been blue ticks doing that, though, would it?
Well, yeah, my blue tick brothers will be hard on me for that. But yeah. He finally, well, he settled down and won. He placed first place night champion at the American Heritage Hunt.
Well, all right.
He turned into a pretty good hound.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's so many things I'd like to talk about the state of Texas and my hunts there, my friends there and all that, and some of the most wonderful times that I had looking back over the years that I worked were at either the American Heritage Hunt or the Texas State Hunt. The Texas State Hunt was like the old preacher said back home. It's about like salvation. It's better felt than telt. You know, that,
right.
You know, you just had to be there and get that atmosphere and get hearing Guy on the microphone or who's our good, dear, sweet English guy that was there forever. Not Floyd Daniels, but I can't forget his name. That's got to come back to me. But he was on the state board for many, many years down around Lufkin, Texas there. I know you know who I'm talking
Dallas
Sanders.
Sanders.
Yes. And mm-hmm. to hear those guys' voices, you know, seemed like it just went on constantly. It was like going to a county fair, you know, and hearing the guy say, come on in here, 3 shots for $1, you know. They were always talking. Man, it was what a great atmosphere. I loved it. That's where I met you the first time.
The first time it sure was. And matter of fact, I think it was I was hunting diesel.
Probably were. Well, listen, I want to talk about this. Now, the reason you and I, we spoke on the phone the other day or maybe through text messaging or whatever. And Corey Groover, my buddy, has been accompanying me on these podcasts, and we've been talking about tree dogs and problems with tree dogs and what kind of tree dogs we like and the different styles and all those things. And we had a couple of episodes and probably can do some more. But I wanted to talk more about track dogs, trail dogs, dogs with good noses, dogs with bad noses, that sort of thing. And I know that historically the blue tick breed has been known to produce good cold trailing dogs. I know that the dry ground lion hunters out west, the Lee brothers, the great lion hunters, if they didn't have, they may not have been purebred blue ticks, a lot of them. They were probably the older style before the blue ticks, split out as their own breed in 1946. From the English breed, but blue ticks have played a real big part in the Southwest especially and all over the country, I guess. You know, I lived in Michigan, and I was in the heart of blue tick country up there with Ed Mead and of course, Dave Dean and Kenny Herman and all these other people up there that were so involved. And I just mentioned to you earlier, and I'll get off on a little sidebar here just a second, our friend Mark Houck with the All-American Blue Tick Association, and that's, I believe, an association you told me you're involved with as well.
Yes, sir.
They're having a tribute to Julius Sebastian. Now, Julius, I met Julius when I was in Michigan, when I first went up there, and he had a great dog. I didn't see her, but a famous dog named Penny, Sebastian's Penny, that showed up on a lot of pedigrees. But Julius was a bear hunter, and apparently your association there is having a big game extravaganza up there at the top of Michigan Houndsman Association in the UP, which... Man, that would be a great time to be up there right now, you know, where it's hot everywhere else. I bet it'd be some nice cool breezes up there. But anyway, I've been around a lot of blue ticks. And then, of course, growing up in West Virginia, you know, there was up at Glenville, West Virginia, was a guy named Avon Ellison that bred, you know, some old line blue ticks. And I think that's where Kelly Bragg, you know, his stock came from. So, you know, I've been around and hunted with a lot of blue ticks down through the years. And I know that you've had some good ones. And I want you to kind of, you know, don't be shy. Just tell us a little bit. I think of Hoss. I think of Domino. I think of Diesel. I'm sure you have some more. But just tell us about your experience a little bit with the blue ticks, you know, of your experience. And then let's talk about them as trail dogs and track dogs.
Well, if you look at it from the way the public looks at it, the two dogs that stand out in my mind that drew attention were noted to be tree dogs. And they were flashy and quick. And that's Hoss and Domino. I had the good fortune that when we were young, Tom Hopkins and I were kind of, you know, a little bit, you know, at odds. He's hunting Lipper, and I'm hunting Domino and Diesel. And then he's hunting Lager and Cash, and I'm still hunting them. And the one thing that I can say about hunting the two dogs differently, I'd hunt one weekend, and then a month later, I'd hunt the other one in another hunt because I didn't get to go a whole lot. There weren't a whole lot of hunts close, and it took a little while. But both people recognized they were both nice hounds. Domino being a flashier dog. He was a pure layup dog, as I've ever owned. He could take a layup coon and just pick it up and go to it. And Hoss was a layup dog, not quite as fancy on laying one up, but he could dog on your getting. Hoss was a track dog this is the thing that I think made Hoss hard to beat in competition. He had a good nose. He did have a good nose. But if he barked on a track, he was going to tree it. Mm-hmm. I couldn't always say that about Diesel or Jake. But
yeah, another name that...
Those two dogs didn't have good noses. They had great noses. They had great noses, and they could smell stuff that I think a lot of dogs couldn't pick it out. And in competition, I've had the Diesel dog hunting out there in one of those kind of rocky fields with that scrub oaks and stuff around Fairfield. To Night Champion Walker Gyps went one way, he went the other way. He was gone. And people don't understand, a lot of times in that country where there's not coons, you may not get a bark for 10 or 15 minutes. This is not going to be a racehorse type atmosphere. Right. The dog may go up a ravine, come back it, go somewhere else. And anyway, Diesel came back and went up the same gully those two females did, and he opened out there about 40 or 50 yards up there, and the gentleman that had the dog said, that blue so-and-so's trailing them two Walker females. And I said, I beg to differ with you. And, of course, I struck him and put him on the paper, and it took him about 20 minutes to get that coon treed, and he trailed that sucker around there and got treed, and the two gyps were on in there deeper and treed, and we found my coon. Theirs was circled. But the icing on the cake, because we treed three coons that night, and I had all three coons. They just, cedar trees and stuff like that, you just you know, luck bears into it. I don't care who you are. But the last one that he treed was a kitten on the ladder to a deer stand.
Yeah.
And you know, I saw him treed on the deer stand. They could see him treed on the deer stand. And I'm betwixt the rock and the hard spot right here. I'm going to win the cast, but I'm not going to have 600 plus points either. And, right. You know, but I walk up, we cream, we go up there, and there's that coon. He's just sitting on that top rung of that ladder, scared to jump off. And you know, you those yips never covered him for whatever reason. But it wasn't uncommon for him to strike and trail a coon by other dogs' treed. I'm talking about come by within sight, and he was centrally focused, and he'd go down there 100 yards or wherever he went, 200 yards, whatever, sit down and tree and have a coon. It was we road hunted him, and so many of these young people think that road hunting a dog teaches them to run the road. And I beg to differ with you 100%. That's how you break them from running the road. You make them take those tracks as they come to them. And that's one of my big deals on a track dog. I want him hunting from my feet. I don't want him racehorsing across there a quarter mile before he ever puts his head down.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's a fundamental difference, you know, with a lot of the philosophy of a lot of hunters today. You know, we hear constantly this term, the dog moves around good. You know, that's one of the things they'll say right away in describing the dog, he moves around good, which means he's looking for a coon. But in my view, you know, generally that means he's looking for a hot one. You know, he's looking for one he can slide under. Well, you know, the terrain in Texas, you know, I learned real quickly when I went to out there in San Angelo, which is, you know, kind of semi-desert country out there. I mean, you got those old dry creek beds and with that have eroded into that red dirt, and you've got, you know, it's just mesquite generally is what you tree a coon on, a small bushy tree, like occasional cottonwood along a creek. But I learned out there real quick in the dog that I took out from West Virginia that had a plenty good enough nose for the Appalachians, you know, for the back east. But man, he was as we used to say, he was like Ned in the First Reader. Man, he didn't know what was going on, you know, out there until he kind of began to catch on to it. But I'd say he did a lot more hitchhiking with those cold-nosed West Texas dogs than he did leading the race.
Something I'm going to say about the dogs that come from this region in here, and I'm going to start with, of course, Tommy and Lipper, then Mark Watley with his the string of dogs that he's had so many good dogs.
Now, Mark, is he a cousin?
Cousin,
yeah.
And he's just done an outstanding job with his string of dogs. And then there was Bo Parker and Red, Reverend Red.
Yes.
And these dogs that come from here, people fail to realize that we can go just a few minutes drive, 30 minutes drive, and we're in Caddo Lake. And that's a small version of the Okefenokee or the Everglades or whatever. It's just its own habitat.
I see.
And it's the same type deal.
Swampy.
Okay, if we turn and go across and get up just a little ways into Oklahoma, you're going to get into the Kiamichi Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
You get out there toward Dallas and maybe a little bit south, and you start getting into the scrub oaks. And it, what I'm saying is you don't have far to go. Up into Arkansas, you can get into the mountains. You get into the farmland. I mean, the availability for the guys that raised and lived and hunted in this area, this is one of the things I've used the term breed for balance. And you'll never be out of place.
Well, and let's stop right here just a minute and talk about, now, first of all, you've mentioned some dogs, Domino, Diesel, Jake, Hoss. Were these all from the same line of dogs?
No, not really. I've always kind of mixed. I felt like there's plenty of good breeders out there, and everybody's got something in the stew, you know. And I don't, myself personally, I don't like a whole lot of Hammer. I don't like a whole lot of Jet, but I do like a little in there enough to give me a little bit of tree style, but I don't want it to the point of where it's going to overpower the dog and make him think, jump too quick.
Yeah, yeah. A little too much tree. Well,
I'm a firm believer that if you have a track dog and he tracks first, he's going to learn to take that track to a tree, and he'll be accurate.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I see what you're saying for sure. You know, I trained quite a bit with Ed Mead, but Ed lived about an hour from me roughly. And he started one of the better plot dogs that I've ever had, a puppy we raised, but he was about 7 months old, had been at my brother's, and I hadn't done anything with him. And I brought him to Michigan and took him over to Ed's and left him, and Ed got him started right away for me. But Ed, you know, if you've watched his videos, and of course Ed has passed, God rest his soul.
Right.
But he had those puppies, you know, 3 and 8 weeks old, maybe earlier than that, you know, and he used that kind of unorthodox method of a landing net, a fish net, you know. And yeah. I just, you two, if you, rather than getting into detail, I'll just tell the listeners, just go onto YouTube and or to Google, you know, Ed Mead and Blue Ticks, and you'll find those old videos on YouTube, I'm sure. But anyway, those dogs, and Dave Dean as well, they had a lot of tree in them, no doubt about it. And they came from country where there were a lot of coons, okay?
And it's understandable.
Yeah, yeah. And you had to be back in their day. You know, you had to go to a night hunt with both Hammers cocked when you dropped them out of the truck. You know, you had to get treed and quick because somebody else was going to do it if you didn't, because quite honestly, they're coon everywhere, you know. And you know, one time Lindell Price, my buddy, you know him well, came up from Virginia, and we turned the dogs down what we call Rocky River down beside a cornfield. We didn't go anywhere near a quarter mile, and we saw 13 coons, you know, and treat them going down that river, you know. So, you know, you don't have that kind of coon in most cases in Texas.
I used to tell people there wasn't but 3 coons in Cass County, and there was all boar coons. And what you done was you treed them coons as you come to them.
Yeah,
they was always out going distant to find the lady folks.
Yeah, I get it.
And you know, I've heard people make statements, a dog can't do this or a dog can't do that, run so far. And here's the deal, track dogs.
Yeah, thanks for bringing me back on track.
Yes, yeah, come down here and get in one of these 500-acre Texas clear cuts. And that in turn, and you can talk to old Tom Hopkins about that, that in turn leads us back to the mutes, you know.
Yeah.
because Tom and Gerald and I and a few more boys hunted on these mules, as does Kerry Costello down here now. And you can take the starch out of one of those high-winding, high-headed pups by putting him in front of that mule. And about three or four days, you've got him looking for a coon. Mm. He's looking for a coon, and he's looking for him quick.
Yeah.
And this thing, to take a track and take it, and people don't understand. 6 inches of this dadgum sugar sand down here. You see a dog working a track on that and carrying it. And I don't mean standing on his head. I'm talking about barking and moving 100 yards every time he barks on the thing.
Yeah.
And three other dogs that you know are decent hounds aren't getting out of sight. And
well,
so
what
when
you
get that,
yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
When you get that dog that has that nose and that ability to move that track and that ability to be accurate, you don't really care for this, what tree style he has. I mean, I used to tell people, I don't care if he's purple, got green spots and yellow stripes, rides a pogo stick, rings a bell on the track, and blows a whistle at the tree if he's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know.
So you take that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know a lot of the guys that are listening, and I get a lot of comment back on these episodes. And most of it is positive. In fact, it runs way on the positive side. And I maybe they're just being gracious and all. But they like to hear the accounts of these older dogs and these older hunts and our historic hunts and so forth. But, you know, that's the way I was raised, to judge a dog by its ability. Number one, to go hunting. You got to have a dog that'll go hunting. You don't want one, you know, that you got to walk over a track. But, you know, that goes and finds that track. It may be hot, but most of the time it's going to be cold. It's a feed track or something like that. And he works it out. He works the puzzle out. And hopefully he's what I always liked was what I called a drifting track dog, a dog that was always reaching out front to try to catch it. You know, that was the object. And I think that's why I stuck with the plot breed all those years, is that those dogs wanted to catch what they were after, you know. And so anyway, I just learned the appreciation for that kind of dog that can do what you're talking about, Dex, was, you know, that was in the heart and soul of coon hunting to me, you know, when I came on the scene, you know.
There's so many people. My son is 51 now, and he hunted Jake for me the first time we qualified him in the world hunt, because it was back when you still had to have a non-hunting judge. And he came in from college, and I asked him, will you handle him? He said, Daddy, I ain't never hunted with a dog. I said, son, ain't but two things you got to know about him: strike him when he balls and tree him when he gurgles. And I took him over to my family's farm. We've got, my grandpa's place and the daddy's and the brother's and stuff's place is across here. And there's a drain on that place that's about a mile and a half long that takes flood water across it and gets it out of there. But it's always an ecosystem that's going to have crawfish, shiners, frogs, mm-hmm. snakes, everything that's a habitat to have a coon. And I took him there, and I aimed him into a 140-acre block of woods behind us. And I started across there, and we're standing there looking, and all 7-8 minutes goes by, and he opens about a quarter mile into the open pasture that's just dotted with trees along that drain. And I said, how'd he do that? I said, I don't know, but he's over there. So we watched that dog, and he drifted that track a mile and a quarter. I know how far he drifted it because I know the roads. I was raised on this place. Right. He drifted that track a mile and a quarter and seven marks. On the eighth mark, he located, and I told the boy, I said, listen to him. He just located. You book him there every time. It doesn't matter if he leaves. You book him there because nine times out of ten, he's parked. Mm-hmm. And anyway.
Now, which dog was this?
This was Jake. Okay. This was Jake, the dog that was hunted in the 97 Purina Points race when we had, what was it, seven or eight blue ticks in the top 10 of the Purina race mm-hmm. that year.
Yeah, yeah. What was Jake's breeding?
Jake went back. He was on the bottom side. He was out of a daughter to Domino that was probably one of the best females that I ever had. I never night championed her. I had a stack of receipts on her almost an inch high. And she just never could get a first place win. But she was as constant as running water. She was a good little hound. And on the top side, she was out of Kenny Jones's Archie Chief, which was out of Horse Ranch Blue Baller that belonged to Kenny Jones and C.W. Eldridge. And he was directly out of Tasuda's Archie. And I'm still a big fan of that breeding. They're not the tree dogs that I think a lot of people like, but I'm not enamored by a tree dog.
Right. When you say that, you're certainly saying that the dog would stay treed. He's just not a real classy, stylish up on the tree
Jake barked about 12 times a minute.
Mm. Yeah.
He wasn't gonna. But he would do that. He would do that till tomorrow evening.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you could run a freight train full of foxhounds by him, and he may get big eared, but he wasn't going nowhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, for those of you out there that are learning your coonhound glossary, getting big eared means the dog is listening for the other dogs. And a lot of times we say they get big eared, they get treed, a young dog will, and another dog falls treed over here, they can't stand it. Their ears get too big listening to that dog, and there they go, you know. But resolve a lot of that down through the years, or at least it did for me. I don't know about anybody else.
One of the things I will say for him, he was just naturally a stay-put tree dog. He was genetically a stay-put tree dog. And I will tell you something else that they may want to hear, because I've seen young people make this mistake. I was hunting him. I just made a grand show champion out of him, and they'd never put him in a hunt because I didn't want him boogered up. And he was a late starter. Again, other people might have owned him. He wouldn't have got a chance to have done anything. But I'm skirting him. I'm running him, and he takes off in there about a quarter, and he's trailing parallel to a road, and he's drifting and drifting and drifting, and he goes in, and he locates on a tree. And this is the old beep-beep system where you didn't have a Garmin, and he shuts up. And I take that old beep-beep system.
And that's a telemetry system for you guys out there. It just emits a radio signal back to the transmitter, to the receiver box, usually. And it shows on a dial, you know, and makes a beep. And that's what we had, and we thought we were in hog heaven when we got those, didn't we?
Oh, no, that was the greatest thing on earth. That was the greatest thing on earth.
Yeah, that's right.
Better than canned biscuits, I'm telling you.
Well, you go ahead, Dex. I interrupted your story.
No. But I went into the tree, and understand, this is a two-year-old dog, and he didn't put his feet on the tree. He didn't slobber or sling his head. He's sitting on his dead butt looking up this tree. Mm-hmm. And I walk in there, and it's obvious the coon is sitting there in the first fork. I mean, the coon's not much over 20 feet above him.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen young people say, well, I'm not going to feed him that coon. He doesn't deserve it no better than he treed. And I say, wrong decision. This dog doesn't know he's got that coon. He only thinks he's got that coon. He only thinks he's got this coon. So I take my beep-beep system, I tie him up right there, and I hoof it back about not quite a quarter mile to the truck, get my single shot 22, and I hook it back in there. And I set the gun down, and I pet on him, and I get him to finally get up there and bark a time or two. And I, you know, back then you had to kind of teach a dog to tree.
Yeah, I understand.
And some dogs, a lot of these young people don't understand that. And that's why you breed for intelligence, is you want that dog to figure out what you want him to do.
Yeah,
I got him to bark a time or two, and when I did, I backed up and I gut shot the coon. And the coon peed down the tree, and when it did, he come uncorked. And when he come uncorked, I petted him up some more, and then I backed up, and then I shot the coon out to him and let him wool it around, and he toted that coon back out for me. And from that time on, that's what made him believe he had these bad tracks. He had to know, and I've seen young people take their dog and you be trying to tell them, say, that dog doesn't know he's got that coon. You need to convince him that he's right. He doesn't know that. And this is just something that's lost because they don't have the heritage. And I'm not knocking them. I'm not knocking these young people, but These dogs were schooled and they got better. You know, these boys are usually getting rid of a dog at 4 or 5 years old, when that's when they should be becoming razor sharp.
Well, I agree with everything you're saying here, Dex. You know, I think today a lot of hunters are missing this altogether, because they're so concentrated on getting to that tree, the dog getting in the country, getting treed, being able, you know, and I've beat this horse to death on this podcast. You know, the handler really isn't that much involved with the dog anymore. But when you take a dog like that, a young dog, and you spend night after night, I've mentioned this to my listeners, and I'm not trying to get any kind of pats on the back or anything, but all the years that I worked in the registry and especially lived in Michigan, I was out there coon hunting 4 or 5 nights a week.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I started a lot of young dogs, and, you know, and I was that hunter you're talking about, spending time with my dogs, you know, learning every grunt, squeal, and whistle, as you say, in that dog. And I just want people to try that. You know, it may not be what wins you $100,000, but it may be something that gives you appreciation for what a dog can actually do, what an intelligent hound that's been gifted with a good sense of smell and our olfactory capabilities. And, you know, and that's kind of what I wanted to get onto here with this talking about. And we can't single out blue ticks. They're good cold-nosed dogs in all breeds. But, you know, what makes a good track dog? What makes a dog, you know, really kind of make the hair stand up on the back of your neck when you see him operate? What is a good track dog, Dex?
Okay, then, and I will say this, and this is just because I haven't seen every dog, but of all the dogs that I've owned and raised as deluxe track dogs, three stand out in my mind, males, and one or two females over the 60 years I've been running with hounds. But you got to figure the last 40 or 50, I was pretty serious about it, so I paid attention. Diesel was a straddle track dog, but he was a straddle track dog that could move. He pushed the track pretty hard, and he took it as he come to it, and he went through it, and he was a dog that was by nature a very solid locating dog, not necessarily a fast locating dog, but a solid locating dog. You didn't have to, not that he wouldn't occasionally move, but generally speaking, when you heard him roll it over a time or two and then go wolf, 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 it's a done deal.
Yeah.
Now, Jake, on the other hand, take the same type of track, and until some Mark Watley bred a female called Moon Pie, one of the best. Steve Kinney had a bitch named Rachel that was a tremendous nose, but they'd take Jake and that type, those two type dogs. You hear them, and they open, and the next time they move, they're moving in a forward direction. And it may be 3 or 4 minutes, and all of a sudden they open again, and they've moved a forward direction again, whether it be 100 yards or 300 yards. And this is the one of the things I love watching Dick Brothers comment on his females that he's got right now. They appear to be that type dog, and they've got a lot of hustle to them. And there's dogs out there that can smell these bad tracks and run them. And we've lost sight of finding those. And mm-hmm. when we find those again, that's part of the reason why I have gone back and working with a couple of the bear hunters, one down in South Georgia, one up in Central Idaho. And mm-hmm. I've got a female out here named Della. She's got a decent nose, not an overpowering nose, but when she finds it, she makes things happen. Her brother, on the other hand, is a dog that can fall off a bear track running wide open and fall in there and bay or catch a bear off a track that's on the ground. And, you know, my goodness, I can't find any fault with that when he comes up with the meat.
Well, I learned more about cold trailing from bear hunting than I mm-hmm. did from coon hunting. And
absolutely. I can see that 100%.
Well, the voice there again, I apologize. Yeah, because the bear will travel so far, and you can get a good picture of, you know, how that dog is able to move that track and get up on that bear and get it jumped or bayed or treated or whatever. But you just learn in the different parts, different times of the year, and seeing how, you know. So there's a lot, it's easier to learn, I think, about cold trailing maybe than it is coon hunting. But I've always marveled at those dogs. And I've owned a few, and my dad before me, that were able to take that track. I'll say this real briefly. Had a plot dog named Bear Pen Sam. He was the foundation sire of the dogs we had for several years. You mentioned road hunting. We had a place called Camp Creek. We started at the top of the mountain, and you rode it down this. There was a mill branch. It ran right off down over the bank to the side of the road. on the other side of that branch, the mountain went straight up. Straight up on the other side, a twisting, turning old civilian conservation corps road where back during the Depression they built that road in there. It was only 4 miles, but it took a long time to get to the bottom because it was just so rocky and so twisting and all that. See, cut to the chase. We talked about hunting dogs in front of a vehicle. We would turn the dogs loose in front of the vehicle, and we're creeping along, you know. I've seen this Sam dog throw his head in the air and drop down over that bank and go down there probably 100, 200 feet, oh, maybe a little more, 500 maybe, depending on the spot, cross that mill branch, and climb up on the other side and get way up on side of the ridge and open when he got to that track. And he had winded that track from the road. And he was one of those that I loved to listen to him because when he gave that first, that strike, it was more like a howl. Oh, you know. And then the next time, like you said, that drifting, he'd be maybe 100 yards, and he'd howl again. And as it started, you know, as he got that thing going, those howls would come a little shorter, a little closer together.
And, they will tell you what you need to know if you learn to listen.
Exactly. And to me, having experienced that, I can't get real excited about getting out here and cutting a dog loose along a cornfield or whatever. And now they want them to open every breath. It's, you know, clear out of sight if they will. And so they can get that first strike, you know. I never understood, though, how a dog could strike right under your feet, shut up, and not open again for a mile, and then get treed. What were they doing between point A and point B? But anyway, that's my preference, you know, because that's the way I was raised. That's the kind of dogs I was raised with.
These oil field roads around East Texas, years ago, they've got lock gates on so many of them because of the leases and stuff now. But I have road hunted diesel across the bottom. And it's 7 miles from one side of the bottom to the other side of the bottom, turned him around and come back over the same road and him strike a pretty hot tune, run it and tree it.
Yeah.
And then I'd get out and rode him all the way back. And so when you figure what I rode him, he rode it about 12 miles. But I have seen the same scenario where he would road hunt at about 8 miles an hour. He would literally hammer dogs to death. You'd put two of them young bucks out there with him, and he'd hammer them down, throw them in the back of the truck, put two more, and all of a sudden he stands up on his back legs, and you can tell he's winded, and him take off and go straight out in there 100, 200 feet and just fall treed.
Mm-hmm.
And or like you said, go in there and get struck. When the berries are thick, is a great time to take those young dogs road hunting because every one of those old oil field roads has got a zillion blackberry vines or muscadine vines or just slow berries or whatever. They're, you know, opossum grapes. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's another thing. So many of these young boys don't know where to go to look. Because they don't know the food chain that these animals are feeding on, and where to go to find what they're needing to put their dog on the training.
Well, for any kind of hunting that you want to choose to do, turkey hunting, duck hunting, deer hunting, whatever, you got to find out what your target animal is eating. You know, and go there. You know. And That's coon hunting 101, folks. And Dexter is right on top of it. You know, you got to know what the coon are eating at the particular time. But now, there again, if you've got a dog that's hunting, you know, a mile out there, you know, maybe he goes until he finds a place that they're feeding. But I always like to go, you know, stack the deck a little bit. You know, in the fall of the year, go on the ridges with the acorns or the possum grapes, as you said, or in summertime in July where the blackberries, or September in the wild cherries in the fence rows, and you know, all those kind of things. But
I want to input here some of Grandpa Watley's rule number one.
All right.
It works right into coon hunting. It works into, and he was a cowman for 8 decades. And he was a sharp cookie on horses and mules. But a lot of the same thing that it takes to train a dog, it takes to train a horse or a mule. Rule number one, don't be stupid, boy. It'll affect every day of your life. Rule number one. If you ain't 10% smarter than the horse you riding or the mule you flying, you in for a long day. Rule number one.
They're all number ones, huh?
They're all number one. In other words, what he's saying is everything in life is important.
Yeah.
Everything in life is important. And he broke his last horse at age 69. And he rode that horse till he was 81 years old. And he got rid of it, and he rode over the place, the fences and stuff, every week on that horse.
Amazing.
But what I'm saying here is don't lose your zeal for something that's going to keep you young. Can I hunt like I used to? Heavens no.
No.
I don't know that I would want to hunt Hoss or Jake or Diesel or Domino or Bubba or Garland, but I've got a little female here named Della, and she happens to be goes back to Iron Will too. But what I have been on top of her, you know what I require of a dog that handles.
Oh yeah.
The straight dog that we had in the Purina national show was my absolutely best old man's dog. He could get treed anywhere, and if I could get to him, he'd stay there. But if I couldn't get to him and I called him, he'd come to me.
Yes.
Della is the same dog. Mm-hmm. She's just not quite as accurate as he is. Number one, because she's not as track minded as he mm-hmm. was.
Mm-hmm.
I get it. I love the competition. But I won't sacrifice the stuff. And I, for that reason, and I'm not saying it's the greatest show on earth, because Ed and Dave Dean had the same thing, but I still have Domino's blood here. I still have Diesel's blood here. But in the process, I've got a little bit of Hammer blood, a little bit of Jake blood, a little bit of Jet blood, a little bit of Uchman blood. They are all ingredients in this pie, and you've got to be able to read the book and feel the ingredients out. If it's too sweet for you, back off the sugar.
Mm-hmm. That's
the whole thing in a nutshell. Don't believe everything you read. Learn from your own life.
Well, that's the old adage, experience is the best teacher, and there's no doubt about that. Dexter, I made a commitment to you before we started to record it. I'd let you go in time for your meeting. I believe you said you had a meeting this evening. You need to go to. I want to ask you one question, and it may be too much of a question for a short answer, but which of those dogs was the best track dog in your mind and why?
The two. It's going to be between Domino and Diesel.
Okay.
I mean, excuse me, it's going to be between Diesel and Jake.
I thought you were going to say Jake.
Yeah, it was going to be Diesel and Jake. Jake could make things happen a little faster. He was just a little quicker footed. And, you know, you think about the dogs that you've seen me with. I like a dog. I don't like a big, bulky dog. I like a dog mm-hmm. that stands up in the air. And Jake was a fine show dog in his own right. Their noses were equal. They just had different styles. It's maybe the difference between having a Charles Barkley and a Michael Jordan. You got to have both, but the one you want to lead. And I'm finding this out with time. I'm finding that Jake was a better grandsire than he was a sire.
There you go.
And that comes from the guy that's patient and willing to stand the test. You know.
Well, here's the thing, Dex, in this, and I think the nugget in all of this that we've talked about tonight, as you were recording in the evening hours. I know a lot of the people who are listening to this in the daytime, but is, you know, there's a lot to be said for just kind of slowing things down, and Mother Nature has a way of doing that, and we've alluded
Absolutely.
To that. You and I both know what that's all about. But you know, great. The competition's great. I loved it. I loved it. Loved it. I love being part of it, being associated with it as I was for so many years. I still do if I could do it. And I'm not denigrating that in any shape or form. But if we could,
absolutely.
If we could pass a nugget on here to the listeners today, is take the time to learn that dog. Take the time to appreciate the tools that that dog's been given and sit back and watch him work.
Put the Garmin in your pocket. Don't look at mm-hmm. the screen. Only if the dog gets lost, pull it out. But put that yeah. Garmin in your pocket and yeah. you will know what he's going to do, what mm-hmm. his next step's going to do. Be. You'll know it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You won't have to look at that Garmin and say, I think he's fixing the tree.
Yeah.
You'll know it.
My buddy Bill Slaughter down here one day, he was always fiddling with his Garmin. Bill's not hunting anymore. But he was one of the guys that was always fussing and complaining about the Garmin. Why, the dogs are over here and it says they're over there and yada, yada. He had the hardest time, you know, learning that thing. But we had a good coon race one night. I mean a jam-up good one. And they made a big circle in there, and they came in back pretty close to us and come on that tree just right, you know, just knocking it down. It was, as Jerry Clower would say, how oh, it was beautiful, you know. But Bill did not hear a sound. You know, I told Bill, I said, you just missed the best coon race of the year fiddling with that Garmin. Oh, Dex, I'm going to let you go, buddy, because I know in order to meet your commitment, you're going to need to get out of here. But I deeply appreciate you coming on to Gone to the Dogs with me.
I want you to know it has been my pleasure. And the best Garmin I've ever owned was a black mule named Roosevelt. No matter where I went or where I was at, he knew where the dogs were, and he knew where the truck was or where the house was.
I got you. All right. Well, there you heard it here first, folks. You might want to trade that Garmin in on a mule. I don't know if Buddy Woodbury up there double U's dealing in mules yet, but Buddy, you might think about that. Dex, it's been a pleasure. Hey, it always is. Let's do this
pleasure,
again.
Steve.
Let's do this again as soon as we can, okay?
I'm ready.
All right, buddy. Well, you have a good evening. And, folks, this is Steve Fielder for Dexter Whatley with the Gone to the Dogs podcast. And if somebody asks you where is Dexter these days, you tell him he's on old Roosevelt and he's gone to the dogs. I'll see you, brother.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.